Okay, so good evening, everyone. Our topic for tonight is Operation Wrath of God. Now, for those who saw the movie Munich, by Steven Spielberg, they're familiar with at least a fictionalized version of some aspects of what we're going to speak about tonight, particularly Operation Spring of Youth, which happened in April of 1973. But let's begin with the fact of Palestinian terrorism against Israel and against Jewish targets all over the world. This began basically in 1968. It's a product of Palestinian feeling of being lost and unrecognized after the Six-Day War. That after the Six-Day War, yes, the Arab states who lost territory to Israel in armed conflict wanted to get it back, but they weren't necessarily desirous of getting things back for the sake of the Palestinian cause. So, in the refugee camps in the West Bank and Gaza and elsewhere, those who had been exiled from their homes in 1948 were interested in making their presence felt on the world stage. Well, the organization which we're going to focus on tonight, Black September, was named after the September events of September 1970, when the PLO was driven out of Jordan by King Hussein's army. The Palestinians militia groups basically had taken over most of the country between 1968 and 1970, and King Hussein recognized that if he wanted the Hashemite dynasty to continue to exist, at some point he had to put his foot down and restore some kind of order. I wouldn't say law and order, but order. And so in the middle of September 1970, he initiated that crackdown. His army started attacking the refugee camps, and in a very bloody maneuver, killed somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 people in the span of about 2 weeks. As the Jordanian army run roughshod over the Palestinian groups. The PLO was forced to evacuate from Lebanon, from Jordan, and go to Lebanon, where it would remain there until the Lebanon War of 1982, so for the next 12 years. So to memorialize, Zecher l'Churban of the Palestinian presence in Jordan, they named their organization Black September. Okay, so Black September's most famous action was the Munich massacre at the Olympic Village on September 5th, 1972. 11 Israelis were killed. Several were killed in the Olympic Village. The others died as a result of a botched rescue attempt at the airfield, a few miles away. Now, when the Olympic Village was stormed, the demand was for the release of 200 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The question for the Israeli government, of course, would be whether or not to seriously entertain releasing the prisoners and capitulating to terrorist demands, or to say, as a fundamental principle, we don't negotiate with terrorists. That's an easy principle to claim you adhere to in easy times. However, when the going gets tough and there are hostages being actively held, who's to say you can really stick to that principle? But in this instance, Golda Meir's government said, we're not releasing anyone. The Germans and the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, refused to halt the games. And so it was like having a dance at Dachau. It was incongruous to have the happy festivities of Olympic athletic competition and an ongoing hostage crisis. Israel and the IDF, particularly Sayeret Matkal, was devising a rescue option that could have been implemented had the Germans given permission for the IDF forces to show up on the scene. However, the Germans adamantly refused. The West German government, the Bavarian state government, said, no, no way, not allowing it. The only Israelis who were permitted to even watch the proceedings and to do so passively on the sideline were Zvi Zamir, Tzvika, who was the head of the Mossad, and Victor Cohen, who was the head of the interrogations division of the Shin Bet. his Cohen's position was that he should have been allowed to directly negotiate with the adversary because he could understand from their choice of words, their body tone, their body language, their intonation, whether they were tired, whether they were ready to capitulate, as he had done in the Sabina episode earlier that year. Okay, but no, the Israelis were kept to the side merely to watch. And as Zvi Zamir said, the most remarkable aspect or the most memorable aspect of the whole thing was when the athletes and coaches were led in handcuffs to the helicopters with thousands of international tourists watching just feet away on the sidelines on the same grassy lawn, that something could, anyone could have stopped it, and no one did. The German police were untrained and disorganized. A traffic jam prevented the elite special forces from arriving on time to the airfield to get to the helicopters. The Germans didn't even make the minimal effort to save lives. Some policemen, in advance of the supposed rescue attempt, had already decided for themselves that they're not going to risk their lives to save Jews. It all went down very badly. Shots were fired, one German police officer was killed, and grenades were lobbed into the helicopters, and all the Israelis were killed. In the process of the shootout, five out of the eight terrorists also died. Now, Golda, who did not watch this as it was happening, it was not televised. There were still footage of it after the fact, but as the rescue attempt was going on, this was not on TV. So Golda didn't know what happened, but she had been misled by people in her office, or possibly by the German officials, that the rescue attempt had been successful. And she called Germany to congratulate Zvi Zamir on a job well done, only for him to have to break the bad news to her that, in fact, they were all gone. They were all dead. The Palestinians saw this as a major success. This was a big victory for them. Now their cause had the world's attention on the world's biggest stage. So whereas there had been prior skyjackings, Leila Khaled got into her trouble in 1969 and 70. I mean, there were other episodes before this. There was the Kozo Okamoto shooting in Lod Airport, but this was the big one where everyone was watching, and now the name Palestine was on everybody's lips. Israel responded right away with strikes, airstrikes on terror bases in Lebanon and Syria, but the cabinet decided on September 11th, 1972, that it was time to go on the offensive and that targets would be attacked even in friendly nations without notifying the governments of those nations and without authorization. That's a major, a bold step forward to say that you're going to attack Palestinian terrorist targets in countries with which you have diplomatic relations without telling their government you're about to kill people. Major step forward. The Mossad's bayonet division, Kidon, was activated. Now, this Munich massacre attempt at rescue failed because Germany lacked experience, it lacked creativity and courage, the likes of which the elite forces of the IDF had exhibited many times over. As I said, five out of the eight terrorists died. What happened to the other three? So the other three were taken to prison. They were convicted of and sentenced to some long sentence, and they were released a few months later. Why? Because of Lufthansa hijacking, in which the deal was you get the plane back and we'll release the hostages if the Munich massacre terrorists are released from prison. Yesh omrim, there are those who say, and this is maybe conspiratorial thinking, maybe this is entirely accurate, that the German government or elements of the German government were in cahoots with the terror organizations and wanted the Lufthansa hijacking in order to absolve themselves of having to hold the remaining three terrorists from Munich. There are those who claim that. I can't say I know for sure, but it's out there. Okay. Now, Black September was an underground within an underground. If Fatah, the principal component of the PLO, led by Yasser Arafat, was theoretically an underground organization, although by the early 1970s was now above board and welcomed at the United Nations in 1974 with the Olive Branch speech. But if it was an underground, then Black September was an underground within the underground, and it didn't formally exist. Therefore, Arafat could deny connection to it. But as was proven over the years, Arafat really was entirely in control, and giving orders what Black September should do. The man who was regarded at the time, and there's some question about this post facto, but the man who was regarded as the brains behind the Munich massacre was Ali Hassan Salameh, otherwise known as the Red Prince. We'll talk more about him soon enough. Now, as Israel decided to go after the perpetrators of Munich, it became necessary to devise some kind of strategy. Now, who was leading the charge? So Tzvi Zamir, the head of the Mossad, and Aaron Yariv, who had been the head of the Amman, the military intelligence, and now was Golda's anti-terrorism advisor. They advised Golda, you got to kill everyone, every last member of Black September you can get your hands on. But Golda hesitated. She was a little reluctant to initiate a targeted killing campaign that would be open-ended and have a plethora of targets. We're not talking about just one person. We're talking about going after a series of people again and again and again and again. It's a serious undertaking. But as the scholars who have written books about Bergman and others about this topic, Michael Bar-Zohar, The History of the Mossad, they say Golda was presented with this idea. She thought about it for a while, and then she remembered the Holocaust and said, send the boys, do what you have to do. So the Shoah, the memory of the Shoah, was weighing on her. Also, bear in mind, Golda's attitude towards Germany had always been hostile. If you recall from a couple of months ago, when we were discussing Israeli-German relations, the guys who wanted good relations with Germany were David Ben-Gurion and Shimon Peres, and to a lesser extent, Moshe Dayan. The ones who thought that Germany was always the evil Germany was Yisr Harel, the original, the earlier head of the Mossad, the guru himself, and Golda, who felt that Germany did not deserve any recognition as a new country, as a reformed country. And the Munich massacre, solidified Golda's interpretation of that as well. Okay. So killing somebody, authorizing their death, is no simple matter. And Golda did not want to do this alone. So she formed a secret committee, the X Committee, that would sign off on the red sheets. The targeted killing targets, and their name and their profile was on a red sheet of paper, asking for permission to bump them off. So who was on this committee? Aside from the Prime Minister, you had the Minister of Defense, Moshe Dayan, and Yigal Allon. In addition, Golda wanted to have a religious stamp of approval for what might have been regarded as an immoral act. So she asked her religious affairs minister, Zorach Farhaftig of the Mafdal, to also sign off on the targeted killings, give a seal of approval, a hechsher. All right. Well, the change in policy that now killings could be done pretty much anywhere in the world, even in what we call base countries, countries where with which Israel has diplomatic relations, and not just in target countries, which are enemy countries, this made things a lot easier. There was a far less chance of getting caught and a far greater chance of coming away with it unscathed and getting the job done in a friendly nation than it was in a hostile nation. In a hostile nation, if you get caught, they'll torture you and kill you. In a friendly nation, worst comes to worst, the team, if they get arrested, will go to jail for a few months, and then Israel will negotiate some kind of a deal with the foreign ministry of the other country. Also, you can act more freely as in terms of surveillance in a friendly nation, whereas in a hostile nation, you got to develop a cover story, which is has to be ironclad. It's very challenging to kill it in a hostile country. So Israel's problem was that the perpetrators of Munich were not in friendly countries. They were mostly in Soviet bloc nations or Arab states like Lebanon, Syria, Algeria, Libya. Okay. So Israel had to fall back upon killing people who were not directly involved in Munich, others, other ranking members of the PLO and Black September, who are guilty of other, terrorist crimes, just not the specific one, which was the straw that broke the camel's back, namely Munich. And the goal was to create a lot of noise and scare people that you could be next. We're on to you and we could get you. So the first target was Wiles Walther. Wiles Walther was living in Rome. This was now October of 1972. And he was a translator who worked at the Libyan embassy. On the surface of things, he was a man of peace who opposed violence. He was translating 1001 Arabian Nights into Italian. And he was a man of Rome. He used to have a baguette, the bread, and he would go back and forth to the embassy, to his apartment. He was a man of the town, a quiet guy, a peaceful guy. But the truth is that he was brutal. Beneath the surface, he was a bad, bad guy. He ran the infamous British Girlfriend operation, which nearly destroyed a plane, where they were smuggling, unbeknownst to them, explosives. After he died, the various terror groups in Lebanon put out an obituary for him, admitting that he was one of their best fighters. Now, what happened to him? They ambushed him by the elevator of his apartment building and shot him 8 times in the back. He never had a chance. Okay. Well, the next target was Dr. Mahmoud Hamshari. And in Spielberg's Munich, this is probably my favorite scene. Hamshari was the number two man of Black September in Europe. And he was responsible for the Swiss air bombing that killed 47 people. He tried to assassinate Golda Meir in Denmark. His apartment was an arsenal for Black September in Europe. And he lived in Paris. And he lived with his wife and his young daughter. In the movie version, the daughter is like 10 years old and is going to school. In the real life version, the daughter was much younger. I think she was a baby. In any event, the goal was to kill him, Hamshari, and not his wife and kid, or for that matter, harm anyone in Paris. And Golda made very clear to Mike Harari, who was running this whole operation. Harari was a very important figure in the Mossad for many, many years. We shall see. The reason why he didn't become the head of the Mossad was because of the failure at Lillehammer, which we'll talk about tonight. But she told Harari, "Don't hurt any French citizens. Make sure they don't get harmed." So the only guy who's going to die is Hamshari. How do they arrange that to happen? So they call him. They want to have an interview because he's some sort of public intellectual, and he goes for the interview in a cafe with Meir Nechemia, Nechemia Meiri, and while he's out at the interview, other Mossad agents break into his apartment and they put a bomb in a telephone stand made out of marble. They replaced his with one that was a lookalike and that had a bomb embedded in it. And then when he got back home, and this was on December 7th, 1972, so Pearl Harbor Day, he picked up the phone, it rang, and they said, "Is this Dr. Hamshari?" And he said, "Yes." And boom, it blew up. Remote control. He didn't die right away. Actually, he was like cut in half. He was severely injured and he died in the hospital about a week or two later. People within the Mossad and within Israeli intelligence began to question why these people were being targeted. After all, they were not the perpetrators of Munich. So this whole process of Operation Wrath of God, Zam Ha'el, a great name, Wrath of God, in which Israel, is taking on the role of the wrath of God. Okay, but you're getting people who are not really associated with the events in question. So the argument that was presented to counter this concern is that we don't draw distinctions between the military wing and the political wing of a terror organization, that they're all the same. A terrorist is a terrorist is a terrorist. And it doesn't matter whether he's writing epistles in the newspaper or and appears to be a peaceful guy translating books into Italian, or he's an intellectual and a professor. The bottom line is, if they're a member of the terror organization, they got to go. We got to dispatch them to Allah's side. All right. Well, the counter argument to that is that Israel was killing those who it could kill, but not really killing those who it should kill. Meaning, there are people who need to be bumped off. And those people are still very much alive. The people who were less significant who were available, that's who they were killing. And that something had to be done. Israel needed to move beyond just Western Europe, Italy and France, and get into the lion's den of Beirut and do something big and bold in Lebanon. Well, before getting to Lebanon, there were several other assassinations that occurred in non-Arab countries. So, for example, the Black September representative in Cyprus was killed twice. You could ask me, how do you kill a guy twice? The answer is, it's not the same guy. But the first representative in Cyprus was killed, he was replaced, and the second one was killed in the same exact way. They detonated his bed when he went to sleep in the Airbnb or the hotel in Cyprus, in Nicosia. Why Cyprus? So the answer is that Cyprus has long been a hotbed of intelligence gathering and activity, clandestine activity. It's close to Israel, but close to the Arab world and close to Europe. And so this was a convenient location for agents and double agents and secret double agents to speak to their handlers and then go back to their own country. The Arabs tended to use Cyprus as a location to try to assassinate Arab spies for Israel who were going to meet their Israeli handlers. Then, after meeting them, they might be in trouble because if they were seen, they could be killed. So Cyprus was a hotbed of activity. Now, Arafat, how did Arafat respond to the double assassination of his representatives in Cyprus? The answer is that he and Ali Hassan Salameh decided we got to do something really, really big. And they planned for a 9/11 style attack on Israel. Of course, you never heard of this because it never happened. It was squashed. But the goal was to have airplanes hijacked and flown into apartment towers in Tel Aviv, killing hundreds, if not thousands, of Israelis. The man who was supposed to run this operation was Bazil al-Kubaisi, maybe a name you might have heard, Kubaisi. But the Mossad tracked him down, and in Paris, they found him in early April of 1973. And on April 6th, they assassinated him. At first they lost him. They didn't know what happened. They were trailing him, and all of a sudden he got into a vehicle after he met a woman of the night on the street. She had propositioned him, and he was a known philanderer. And so he went, and they said, "Oh no, this prostitute basically cost us the whole operation." But Zvi Zamir said, "Don't worry, he'll be back here in 20 minutes." And he was, and they killed him. Okay. So it was time for Operation Spring of Youth. And the goal was to kill all the highest ranking Black September and PLO Fatah officials and PFLP, Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine officials, in Beirut. The urgency with which this had to be undertaken was because Salomé really, at this point, was seen by the Western countries, by the United States, as a real devil, a real scoundrel. I mean, you folks may remember the episode at the Saudi embassy in Khartoum in Sudan in 1973, when under the orders of Salomé, Palestinian terrorists assassinated the American ambassador, Cleo Noel, and several other Americans. And they did so in gruesome fashion, first by shooting them in the foot, and then in the leg, and then up, 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 up in the body until they chopped apart their whole body. So Arafat was responsible for this and was one of the reasons why in the 1990s, after the Oslo Accord, there was some serious hesitation about allowing Arafat into the United States, because after all, under his orders and Salome's orders, the American ambassador had been killed. All right, but obviously the Clinton administration and the others didn't do anything about it. So it's time for Spring of Youth. How does Israel have sufficient intelligence information to make this attack possible? The answer is because a man by the name of Clovis Francis, he was a Lebanese Christian who had for years, since the 1940s, been supplying Israel with photographic evidence of the goings-on in Lebanon, and he gave the Amman, the Israel Military Intelligence, the home addresses of four of the top PLO officials in Beirut. And as it turned out, three of them lived in the same apartment building on Verdun Street. So it could be possible in one bold operation to knock out a substantial portion of PLO leadership. Who did the reconnaissance work? So a Mossad operative by the name of Yael, or her field name was Nielsen. Maybe meant it to Lindsay Nielsen, Leslie Nielsen, I don't know. Okay. So she did reconnaissance work while pretending to do a documentary about the British philanthropist and noblewoman Lady Hester Stanhope, who was a 19th century figure who had spent her la her dying years in Lebanon and Syria. So that was her cover story, that she's doing a documentary and needed to travel around, and she's kosher in the books of the Lebanese. Caesarea, which was the branch of Mossad that does the long-term surveillance, had to scope out what's the best place to do the landing, because this is going to be a water landing that the Israeli Navy is going to bring special forces onto the beaches, and from the beaches to rent-a-cars, and from the rent-a-cars to the apartment building where the PLO leadership is. So Caesarea and the operatives had to carefully plot out the exact course. Keep it to a minimum. Keep it as safe as possible away from Lebanese Beirut police officers or Lebanese military. Make sure that you don't encounter opposition. The problem was that it was fine for most targeted killings for Caesarea operatives to do the scouting and for the bayonet or Kidon operatives to do the killing itself, the shooting. But in this instance, there were too many targets in a densely populated suburb, residential area of Beirut. So the only way this was going to work was with the firepower of the IDF. The Sayeret Matkal, the elite commando forces, together with the Navy, is going to have to get involved. Okay. Well, David Elazar, Dado, as who was the chief of staff at the time, Dado of Yom Kippur War fame or infamy, he didn't like this idea of sending the IDF to do a targeted killing in Lebanon. Didn't like it. He thought it was too dangerous, risky, it's a bad idea. However, the man who convinced him that he could figure out, he could devise a plan that would work, was Ehud Barak. And Barak came up with an idea. He wanted a small squad with the element of surprise, driving right up to the building, blowing the doors open off of the apartments and shooting the targets. And he felt that it could be done by having romantic couples stroll through the streets of Beirut. Now, these romantic couples involved two guys, not a guy and a girl, but one of the guys was, or each couple was dressed like a girl. So Ehud Barak and Muki Betzer were a married couple or a boyfriend and girlfriend. Muki was the guy, Ehud was the girl with a wig and makeup and a female form, and he was able to conceal weapons and explosives by dressing up as a female. It was all going to work just fine, so Ehud said, and it turned out basically he was right. This plan really did work. There was a problem though with using Sayeret Matkal in place of Mossad hit squad to do the killing. And that is that Sayeret Matkal was an elite commando force intended for rescue operations and conventional military activities, which this was not. This was a spy mission followed by shooting up high profile enemy. And members of the Shomer HaTzair, the left-wing Shomer HaTzair, who were well represented in the Sayeret Matkal, said, "Hey, we didn't sign up to be assassins and cold-blooded killers. We don't want to do this." But they were convinced by their leadership that, you know what, you may not have thought you signed up for this, but Am Yisrael needs you, and Jewish blood was shed. Therefore, you got to do it. And the argument worked, and in fact, some of the Shomer HaTzair guys ended up becoming leaders of this mission. Of the 80 guys who went sent on the mission, some of those guys were at the top at the front. The water landing by the Israeli Navy, by the flotilla, was going to be at the private beach of the Sands Hotel. Why the private beach? Well, less likely that people will see the little dinghies, the rubber dinghies, coming up to the shoreline. And then 80 guys are going to go into the rent-a-cars, some of them into the rent-a-cars, some of them by other means, going to drive down the street towards the target. This was the largest targeted killing of the 20th century. There was no rescue option. If it failed, they'd all be caught and probably not end up alive. The targets were Al-Nager, who was known as Abu Yusuf, Kamal Nasir, and Kamal Adwan. They all ended up getting killed. One of their wives was killed. There was one innocent bystander who was killed. And then the other target in this hit of Operation Spring of Youth was the headquarters of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. And 35 members of PFLP were killed when the building was collapsed with 80 tons, 80 kilograms of TNT. And unfortunately, two IDF soldiers died from blood loss, from getting shot, and the rescue attempt not going well. One of them died in surgery on the boat. Now, the Israeli casualties, unfortunately, were the result of the Mossad Caesarea operatives being scared of combat and messing up and driving away too soon. There was a big problem before the mission started. Some of the leadership on the IDF side did not like the fact that they were relying upon Mossad agents who had no combat experience to drive them and be involved in this operation. And they asked some of the guys in the Mossad, "When was the last time you held a weapon?" And some of them said, "I never held a weapon." You know, this notion that the Mossad agents were like James Bond, shooting people up all the time and having all sorts of weapons training wasn't really true. On the Kidon side, on the bayonet side, yes. But on the surveillance side, no. These guys were just good with language skills and impersonation. They could develop a cover story and slip into foreign countries. But some of them had no military experience whatsoever. They never even served in the IDF. So the idea of the guns going off and guns blazing, they got scared. And as it turned out, two people died on the Israeli side as a result. Okay, but despite the casualties, this was a big success for Israel. They destroyed weapons workshops that belonged to the PLO. They seized documents, which proved to be very important because it exposed who the bad actors were in Black September and explained certain previous terrorist incidents that had not yet been fully understood. It was a catastrophe for the Palestinians. The Lebanese government resigned in disgrace. And the legend grew that Israel, or more specifically the Mossad, could attack anyone at any time and get away with it. So if ever there was, the legend growing, it was probably the Eichmann capture and Operation Spring of Youth were like the two greatest accomplishments of Mossad teams. However, the one guy they really wanted most, Ali Hassan Salameh, they didn't get. He was sleeping peacefully in another apartment 50 yards away, and nobody knew. So, yes, people involved in Munich, Black September leadership, were finally being hit hard, but the guy at the very top had gotten away. Now, I mentioned that the seizure of documents proved important in explaining a prior terror incident. So, I'm referring to the Passover affair. The Passover affair was in 1971, and it was a plot by the PLO to blow up nine Tel Aviv hotels on the Seder night. Now, this might sound, well, that's crazy. How could they do that? Yeah, well, during the Second Intifada, the Park Hotel was blown up during the Seder. And on my first trip to Israel with the Great Nick Synagogue Mission, which was 2002, we davened mincha in the Park Hotel. I remember seeing blood still on the ceiling. So the idea of blowing up a Seder, okay, it's time and again it's been attempted. But what happened was that plastic explosives were being brought to Israel by dupes, by people who didn't know that they were bringing it. And the bad guy who was in charge of this was Mohammed Boudia. Mohammed Boudia was a theater director in Paris. Paris again being a hotbed of Palestinian terror activity. He was an actor. He was a man about town. and the Mossad named him Bluebeard. They killed him with a car bomb on June 29th, 1973. Okay, but where was Ali Hassan Salameh? Where was he? Mossad got a tip that he was in Lillehammer, Norway. If you don't know the history of Israel and the Mossad, the only reason you'd ever hear of Lillehammer was the Olympics were there like 30 years ago. All right, the Winter Olympics. But they had this tip that Salameh was in Lillehammer. Who was Salameh? He was about a 30-year-old guy, a little bit older maybe. And his father had been Hassan Salameh, one of the two leading Palestinian fighters in the Palestinian militia of the 1947-48 war. So, Israel's War of Independence, the Palestinian Nakba, they had some military leaders who died. One was al-Husseini, who died in April of 48, and the other was Salameh. So Ali Hassan, the son of the hero, grew up with big shoes to fill. And he became like Yasser Arafat's adopted son. He was seen as being groomed to take over the PLO for or Fatah for Arafat, the next generation. So here he's the Dor Vador, the next generation. But he was a bad guy. He was involved in the shooting of the embassy in 73. He had connections to the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany. But the Mossad thought they found him in Norway. They found him with a heavily pregnant white Norwegian girlfriend. Some said, this can't be him. It's not him. Why? Because this guy speaks Norwegian fluently. And there's no way that Ali Hassan Salameh, a Palestinian who's been living his life in the Middle East, speaks fluent Norwegian. Okay, so they send some surveillance agents from the Mossad to check out what's the story here. Is this really Salameh? And Sylvia Raphael, one of the most fascinating of all the Mossad agents, you can read her biography. Sylvia Raphael was a South African half Jew, the wrong half. Her father was a Jew. Her mother was a Christian. She was raised a Christian. In her mid-20s, in 1963, I believe, she experienced an anti-Semitic episode and all of a sudden had a yearning to go to Israel and became a devout Zionist and joined the Mossad and was obviously very talented in terms of language and impersonation and skills of blending in. So she was checking out Norway under the premise that she was a Canadian anti-Israel photographer named Patricia Roxborough. So Patricia Roxborough is an anti-Israel Canadian. It's really Sylvia Raphael, the half-Jewish Israeli Mossad agent. And there were doubts about whether this guy was Salome, this Norwegian fellow. But despite the doubts, both Zvi Zamir and Mike Harari said, forget about all these question marks. Let's kill him. Why? Because even if he's not Ali Hassan Salameh, he must be some kind of terrorist because he was meeting with a terrorist in the cafe in Lillehammer. And it's the tip that led him the Mossad to think it was him was that he had a meeting with a guy who was a known bad actor. Okay, so let's connect the dots. This guy's also a bad actor. Even if he's not Salameh, he deserves to die. Okay, well, what happened? They do the hit. The guy's coming out of a movie theater with his pregnant, 7 month pregnant girlfriend. It turned out it was his wife. It wasn't a girlfriend, it was his wife. Her name was Toril. And they shoot him 8 times. But then the team messes up. Several major blunders happen, which led to the arrest of six Mossad agents. What happened? Somebody witnessed the getaway car. It was a Peugeot, it was a certain color, or they got the license plate. And so when the team went to return the vehicle at the rental counter, at the Avis rental counter at the airport, the police were waiting for them and arrested them. Then the guy they arrested had claustrophobia, and from the claustrophobia, he couldn't take it, and he gave up further information. More people were arrested, and a Mossad safe house was uncovered. Documents were revealed. The whole Mossad operation in Europe basically was compromised as a result of the Lillehammer affair. So this was really, really bad. But what made matters worse was they killed the wrong guy. It wasn't Ali Hassan Salameh. It was Ahmed Bouchiki, who was just some poor schnook. He was a waiter from Morocco and a pool attendant. And his wife was a native Norwegian, and they had a child, and she was pregnant with the second kid. So this is a whole disaster. They killed the wrong guy, and they got caught. Well, as a result of getting caught, so the Mossad had to clean house. Several agents were fired. Mike Harari, who was responsible here and who was in line to take over the Mossad eventually, never became the head of the Mossad, ended up quitting in like the late 70s and doing other things outside of government service in the 1980s and 90s. Sylvia was arrested, Sylvia Raphael. Interestingly, she married her Norwegian attorney. So here, the half Jew, the wrong half, who's an Israeli but not really Jewish, marries a goy, marries a Norwegian attorney, and she ended up living back in Norway later in life and died in 2005 and is buried in Israel. If you want to read a bit more about her, it's an interesting biography of hers. Israel had to pay $400,000 to the family of Bouchiki for killing an innocent man. And those who were arrested were sentenced to prison sentences. Some would have served a few years if not for the fact that Israel and Norway were able to quietly negotiate some kind of an arrangement to let them go pretty quickly. But that usually is what happens when you get caught in a friendly country. Okay, so the bayonet group within the Mossad was disbanded. Operation Wrath of God came to a quick conclusion. And Caesarea, the surveillance wing of the Mossad, had to change its tactics and be very much more cautious than it had been up until that point. Okay, so there were more targeted killings in the mid 70s. Wadi Haddad was killed with toothpaste. If you read Bergman's book, you'll read that story. But the toothpaste episode. But Salomé was still on the loose. What happened to Ali Hassan Salomé? So after his involvement in Black September, he came to develop relations with the CIA, with other Western intelligence organizations, and Arafat bumped him up to be the head of Force 17. Force 17 was the protective services for Palestinian VIPs, for Arafat himself and for others. So, Salomé now had a day job in Lebanon, in Beirut, guarding the most prestigious of the Palestinian freedom fighters, or as they would call them. So, what happens next? Salomé meets Miss Universe, Georgina Rich, in 1975. She was regarded as the most beautiful woman in the world, and they get married in 1977. They have a child in 1978. And there's a hint, there's a tip-off that Salomé is in Beirut and that his daily routine is very predictable and he could be an easy target. So the Mossad sends Erica Chambers, not her real name, but Erica Chambers, pretending to be a British tourist, to do some surveillance in Beirut. And the Mossad eventually kills Ali Hassan Salomé on January 21st, 1979, by a remote control bomb that was placed in a car, and Salome's motorcade, a two-car motorcade, was passing by it, and they blew up the other car when his car was within a few feet, and he became a mangled wreck and was dead on the spot. So that was the end of the Red Prince. His life and his death became the subject of multiple documentaries. You can look him on Netflix. They have documentaries about him. He was an interesting player in the Palestinian scene, but he died at a young age in his early 30s. Now, a fascinating postscript to this is that in 1996, Michael Bar-Zohar, who wrote one of the important books about the Mossad, was at a party in Jerusalem, and all of a sudden, there's dancing, there's music. And he sees someone who introduces himself as Ali Hassan Salomé and said, "Hey, that's the name of, the Red Prince who died 17 years ago. Who are you?" And the guy says, "Well, that he was my father. I'm named after him. I was 2 years old when he died." And My father was a man of war in a time of war, but I'm a man of peace in a time of peace. And therefore, I can party with the Israelis. So I don't, I mean, that guy must be about in his mid-40s by now, a few years older than me. I wonder where he is today and what he thinks. But at least, in the heady days of Oslo of the 1990s, Salome's son was palling around with, I guess, centrist or left-wing Israelis in Jerusalem. Okay, so this is the story of Operation Wrath of God, in particular, the big one, Operation Spring of Youth, with Ehud Barak and then the assassinations in Beirut in April of 73. But the big question from this whole story is whether or not the revenge policy after Munich really did anything constructive for Israel or not. Were the targeted killings helpful in the sense that maybe they curtailed Palestinian terrorism for some time? Were they harmful in giving Israel a bad name, a shame ra on the international stage? Or did it basically have no effect whatsoever? Israel is Israel, its friends are its friends, its enemies are its enemies. Palestinian terror basically continues, and one bad actor is replaced with another bad actor. And I'll tell you, yesh omrim this, yesh omrim this, and yesh omrim that. It's a chiluke deot, a disagreement, a difference of opinion as to the relative worth of all this killing. There are those who would say, yes, there was a substantial diminution in hijackings and terrorism on the ground in Israel after Operation Spring of Youth or after Operation Wrath of God, that the worst excesses of Palestinian terrorism were basically from 1969 till about 1974, and then it kind of dropped off. Others would argue, baloney. There was the Maalot massacre. There was the Coastal Road massacre. There was the episode in Nahariya in the late 70s. So there were always PLO attempts to kill people. You could try to run the numbers. Maybe there was a slight decline, but it's not as though that killing Abu Yusuf or killing this guy, killing that guy solved all the problems. Other people stepped up and did bad things. All right, so. Depending upon your perspective, you can either say this was worthwhile or not. Now, there's a further component to it to say, well, forget about whether it produced greater security. There's also the emotional component of, but we want our revenge. Jewish blood was shed, let the enemy lose a few lives as well. And it's hard to ignore that aspect of the equation, especially, in the immediate aftermath of a horrific attack like Munich. There is a desire for, for some retribution, and the retribution was quick and coming. It wasn't necessarily to the people who were directly involved, but, to somebody on the other team. All right, I'll take a couple of questions. Unmute. Second. All right, you can unmute if you would like. Anybody? Yes, no, maybe.
I have a
Okay,
question.
yeah. Ask a question, Eli.
Of current events, is Cyprus still a hotbed? Because I'm going to a golf outing there.
I don't know. I don't want to give an answer that's incorrect. I don't know. But enjoy your golf outing. Come back safe. All right. On that note, everybody, see you in 2 weeks. Our topic will be Entebbe, 1976. See you soon.